Hey there, I'm Amanda from Berkeley, California.
Hi, I'm Chris from Indianapolis.
Hey, I'm Hunter from Philadelphia.
The Sound of Young America is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne, live on tape from my house in Los Angeles. It's the Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program is the acclaimed novelist Colson Whitehead. He is, among other things, the winner of a MacArthur Fellowship, the author of several novels, including Apex Hides the Hurt, and most recently, Sag Harbor, which is a story about middle-class African-American adolescence in a resort town on the East Coast, enjoying a summer in which almost nothing happens. Colson Whitehead, welcome to the Sound of Young America. It's great to have you here.
Hey, howdy. Thanks a lot.
So I want to ask you this. It seems like almost like one of the mission statements of this book is the idea that like you can write a compelling book about a group of adolescent characters going through a summer where like they don't stumble into an abandoned mine shaft or like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and find a dead body or get chased by the KKK.
Yeah, just any of those. None of those things happen in this book. And, you know, maybe they end up at like 105% of their previous level of maturity and intelligence at the end of the text.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in my life, I didn't have those crazy adventures. So I was thinking, how can I be true to the experience of summer? And you're not that smarter, despite all your dreams of reinvention. You're not tested by finding a dead body in the woods or et cetera. So the test or the challenge becomes, how do I take these sort of mundane moments, your first job, first kiss, drinking some beers for the first time, and elevate them to the status of something interesting?
Did you ever consider the possibility that maybe in order to get a narrative out of it, you should introduce some big inciting incident like, you know, somebody gets eaten by a wolf or whatever?
Well, yeah. I mean, I definitely had worries because when I started, but I knew that I was going in with this idea that I could be true to the rhythms of most people's summers. And so if that's the challenge, how do you make it work?
Tell me a little bit about what you were like as a teenager. The characters in this book seem, at least in this one summer context, for adolescents, relatively untortured. And I wonder whether that was your experience of adolescence, whether you were able to relatively peacefully, you know, put away your Dungeons and Dragons books in the closet.
No, I mean, it was, you know, I think I found my teenage years pretty horrible, and it took me, you know, about 20 years or 25 years to be able to have enough perspective to write about teenagers. There'd always be these, you know, campy TV shows on Fox, and all my friends in adulthood would say, oh, let's watch these shows. I can't watch shows with teenagers. I hate reading books about teenagers. I didn't like being a teenager. And then I think a couple of years ago, it just seemed that if I did hate it so much, it'd be nice torture to write a book about teenagers. I think I cheat a bit because it's the narrator is a grown up looking back on his teenage times. I didn't want to like try to recreate 80s slang, and that just seems sort of tedious.
One of the things that the book is about is the idea of this place, Sag Harbor, as being this kind of special refuge, like a world outside of, for especially for privileged African-American people, this world outside of, you know, being the, you know, the black lawyer on the team of lawyers at the big corporation, or being the black kid at a private school, or whatever, being in this community of people who are in about the same place as you were and had been for, and sort of that parody move going back for generations. What did it mean for you as a kid to go out to this place for the summer as opposed to, I think you went to like New York private schools, right?
Yeah. Well, for me, I mean, it didn't really mean anything. It was just a place I went in the summer. We took it for granted. We didn't know that how special it was. I didn't really sort of become aware of that until I was in my 30s. So for me, it was just a place I went in the summer It's where I was probably conceived, and it's what I did in between June and August. So it didn't actually have any special import until in my 30s and sick of the New York hustle and needing to get out of the city for a while and staying at my mother's house for a weekend.
How is it different? Why do you think it's a place where, you know, you could tell this story set in 1985, but maybe less well in 2010?
I chose 85 because the Hamptons hadn't really encroached upon Sag Harbor yet. It was still kind of a sleepy little village. It was a whaling town. It's mentioned in Moby Dick. And, you know, I remember growing up, there were all these bumper stickers saying, you know, I had a whale of the time in Sag Harbor. It was just sort of really corny. But then, of course, a club opened up in 84, and that sort of brought big names in and celebrities. And so the town started to change. So it seemed like in the same way that these boys I'm talking about are becoming men in their sort of slow way, the town of Sag Harbor was also in the midst of this transformation. And so from being very sort of inward looking and then being part of like this larger Hamptons community, in the same way that the boys are sort of clueless, but then trying to find their way in the larger teenage codes. And so it seemed like 85 was just a great moment to have this sort of overlap in subject.
There's this thing that people are always saying about teenagers, that like everything is operatic, everything is five times more important than it should be. And usually that's something that's applied to like breaking up with a girlfriend and then you're like so sad that you're considering suicide. And in your book, like it's largely applied to like frozen dinner brand loyalty,
right? Yeah,
and things like that. And I found myself reading it, and it felt so vivid. And I wondered whether you were still like in touch with that part of 15-year-old Colton Whitehead that so passionately cared about those kinds of things.
Well, I think it's part of a feature of how I write. You know, before I started doing fiction, I was a critic, and I really was sort of trying to zoom in and get to the heart of things and try to explain them to my readers. And part of that impulse is still in my fiction.
Let's talk for a second about pop culture. 1985 is not just an auspicious time in the history of Sag Harbor; it's also an auspicious time in the history of hip hop. It's basically the time when the kind of like let's all rap together and be goofy and have a goofy fun party thing is receding in the face of the sort of next things, which are either very serious kind of politically conscious hip hop or gangster rap. And then so sort of third way, which is like mega, you know, bust a move type pop rap. And the two like big hip hop tracks in the book are The Message by the Furious Five. And there's a lot of arguments about what Melly Mel is saying when he says he broke his sacroiliac.
Yes.
Because I'm pretty sure in the song he does say sacrodiliac, which is very confusing to me. And it wasn't until I read it in the book and decided to look it up that I knew what he was talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was trying to figure out which, you know, pop culture moments I could use, you know, for the character. And I think I decided on 85, even though it didn't make it into the book, because of the debut of the single Lottie Dottie and the show. And for me, that was a huge revelation. July, someone brought a bootleg from the city, and it was just a new sort of way of approaching hip hop. And it wasn't the sort of camp of Roxanne, Roxanne. It was much different from the stuff that was on Horizon, say NWA, like three or four years later. So I figured I would have like, you know, set piece about Lottie Dottie. It didn't work out, and you know, and Grandmaster Flash became a better track to use, and Roxanne, Roxanne, the Roxanne Wars. So you know, I'm always trying to find where the subjects bleed into each other. So Sag Harbor is on the cusp of this moment. The boys are, and so is the music that they're listening to and obsessing over. And so all of it, hopefully, is making this narrative about change to adulthood or this new sort of version.
Yeah, let's talk for a second about Roxanne, Roxanne, and UTFO. One of the big set pieces in the book is the gang trying to get into a UTFO show. And Yeah, I listened to Roxanne. I hadn't listened to it in a while, and I was thinking about UTFO, which frankly I hadn't done in a while. And what was coming up was like, this is spectacularly corny. Like, this is the corniest thing in the history. One of the guys dresses up like a doctor. One of the, you know what I mean? Like, with the educated rapper, the one guy. It's like, it's the silliest thing in the history of the world.
Well, yeah, it's like a Village People type dress-up that they're engaged in.
And that's a very different kind of tension between poppiness and corniness than what would emerge, you know, 5 years later, which was, or 10 years later, which was either you are... kind of either you're gangsta or you're not gangsta, and anything that isn't gangsta is corny. And so like the difference between Run DMC and UTFO is not about which one's more thugged. It's about a weird other kind of corniness. And that's a big kind of identity of trying to figure out what, you know, what culture you are without defining it in terms of am I hood or not. Is a big part of the book too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in one or two chapters. I mean, hopefully, you know, when I was conceiving the book, I thought I sort of saw each chapter as, you know, attacking a certain segment of their personalities. And so the chapter that deals with, you know, most explicitly with this is the BB gun war chapter, where they're middle class boys who have anxieties about being middle class and are they real enough. What do these guns, which are, you know, just BB guns, but they look like real guns, and you sort of start engaging in a sort of more and more serious play with them. What does it actually mean to them? And how does it resonate in terms of their ideas of are they authentic or not authentic enough? So, you know, I think one of the strategies in the book, since there isn't, you know, that, you know, we talked about that strong plot line, ways that these different episodes, whether it's the ice cream chapter or the go to the beach chapter or, you know, or the sneak into the club chapter, that these larger thematic concerns can move from chapter to chapter and then provide that sort of structure.
Production of The Sound of Young America is underwritten in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the novelist Colson Whitehead. His latest book is about a group of African-American boys in the African-American Eastern Seaboard summer destination, Sag Harbor. Was it a conscious choice for you to set these main characters on sort of relatively equal footing class-wise and in a world where most of the story is not taking place in contexts where they're dealing with people from the other, I don't know, the East Coast geography, but the places where, like, capital R, rich people live rather than people whose parents are successful professionals? Was it important to you to keep that focus tight on stuff that's within this small world?
Well, I mean, you know, it all takes place in Sag Harbor during the summer, and that's definitely my perception growing up. Maybe your parent was a doctor, or maybe your parent was a teacher, and they're making very disparate amounts of money, and they're just there because their grandparents moved out there, and, you know, the house has been passed on. So, I mean, there was a variety of socioeconomic levels going, well, yeah, whatever, I'm not, you know, whatever you want to term it. But we were all just there for 3 months, and we'd barely see each other during the school year, and then we'd come back and reboot come June. So the unifying thing was really just being out there and on our own, you know, apart from, you know, the fact that the kids in the book are 15 and their parents only come out on weekends. I can't imagine now, like, letting my 8-year-old just leave at 10 a.m. and come back when the lights come on.
You know, that was something just, like, I couldn't. I seemed unreal. The idea that I was trying to figure out if I was misinterpreting things. But one of the things that's going on here is these kids are all heading out to these houses by themselves while the parents work in the city during the week.
Yeah, so it's just, you know, like, Mr. Spaulding next door will keep an eye on things, or you know, somebody's mom is out in case you get hit by a car and have to go to the emergency room. But the way the book is set up, and you know, for a summer or two, there's some overlap with my experience. You know, we were kind of good kids. We were nerds, and we weren't like shooting up. We weren't having sex. We were thinking about having sex, but we weren't having it. I think now people would call it Child Protective Services, but it was there's a lot of it going on. Basically,
there's something like almost scary about the idea of, you know, I mean, being adolescent is all about breaking loose from your parents. But the idea of having to deal with adolescence, like actually with no parents, that's terrifying to me.
Well, you start, you know, you make your own rules and you fall into your own sort of patterns of what you can and can't do. And I think that's sort of laid out in the book. Like, what levels of transgression are they at 15 or 14? Going to commit.
It involves BB guns and wine coolers rather than actual guns and heroin.
And, you know, 2 years later would be different. 3 years later would be if they're 3 years older, it would be different. But, you know, at this, you know, segment of time, you know, they're pretty harmless.
After you spent 2 years or whatever it ended up being, sort of digging into this part of your life and this subject, did you feel differently about it than you did when you decided to, you know, undertake that effort?
Well, I think in the same way that, you know, with most of my books, I have some sort of question I want to solve, and solving it is, and writing, solving the question is writing the book. I did, you know, figure out certain things about being a live, awake human being when you're 15 versus 38. Think about these different ways of being in the world, comfortable, uncomfortable in your skin, being hopeful or despairing of ever approaching that, you know, ideal self that you're, you know, trying to move toward. So, you know, I think, you know, hopefully by the end of the book, I have learned something. You know, hopefully, I don't have all the answers when I start a project, and the ups and downs and the sort of blind alleys are a way of finding eventually my way to some sort of new way of thinking about my world.
When it is literally your world that you're writing about, when it's this part of yourself, like this identity forming part of your personal history, how did it actually literally affect your idea of who that you was and who the contemporary you are, besides this, the proclamation that it did?
For me, I'm going to say now I'm not so squeamish about teenagers or thinking about that time. I put some things to rest, and I can see the through line from my adolescence to who I am now. In terms of the characters in the book, it's much more compact and it's much more linear. You know, at the end of the book, there has to be a certain sort of summation going on. And so the adult, the mature version of Benji is shaping things and, you know, trying to figure out what happened in the summer. You know, my summers weren't that tidy, and yours probably weren't either. But there does have to be a certain kind of unity in the book in the absence of these great melodramatic moments where there's a killer shark or a murder on a loose. And so... you know, that final movement in the book, which I really liked in the last two or three chapters, of where the summer's coming to a close and the mature version of Benji is shaping things. I had a great time writing it and pulling these sort of really small scale lessons out of the summer. I think was very satisfying as a writer.
Well, Colson, thank you so much for taking the time to be on The Sound of Young America. It was great to have you.
Thank you, sir.
Colson Whitehead's new novel is called Sag Harbor. That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I have been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our editor is Nick White. Our associate producer, Julia Smith. Christian Natividad is our intern. My dog's name is Coco. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, and you can email me at jesse@MaximumFun.org. Should you visit our website, you'll find not only free downloads of every Sound of Young America interview, but also our podcasts, including but not limited to The Sound of Young America.
You can check out Jordan Jesse Go, Stop Podcasting Yourself, the Casper Hauser Comedy Podcast, and more, all free at MaximumFun.org. We'll see you next time, right here on The Sound of Young America.